It's Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013, and you are listening to Farm to Fork on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, Northampton, 103.3 FM. Farm to Fork is made possible by the support of River Valley Market, Northampton's locally grown food co-op, located at 330 North King Street, just south off I-91 at exit 21. The co-op specializes in fresh, local, and organically grown foods, from produce and cheese to fresh meats and locally baked breads. Everyone is welcome. River Valley Market is open 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. daily. This program is also made possible by the support of Local Burger, Inc. of Northampton, Mass. Local Burger, Inc. is located at 16 Main Street in Northampton. Telephone number 413-586-5857. For more information, please go to www.localnorthampton.com.
Listening to Farm to Fork on Valley Free Radio 103.3 FM WXOJLP Northampton. The theme song for Farm to Fork was written and performed by Scraggly Dan and the Stragglers. Welcome to Farm to Fork, a program dedicated to the history and progression of the food system within the Pioneer Valley. The program will tackle the complexity of food within different production schemes and consumer markets. My name is Robin, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Sue Timberlake and Jessica Tanner.
Hi, everyone. This is Sue, and for today's show, we thought it'd be really helpful for area gardeners to hear about best practices for biological soil management from Dan Kittredge of the Bionutrient Food Association. Dan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dan, we were hoping you could just introduce yourself, maybe share a little bit with our listening audience about your business association's background, how you came to provide workshops about soil, maybe what other workshops you offer.
Sure. Well, I grew up on an organic farm in Barrie, Mass., across the Quabbin from the Pioneer Valley, and it was an organic farm homestead, so starting in the early 80s through I graduated high school in 95. That was also the location that NOFA Massachusetts is run out of. My parents run NOFA Summer Conference at Hampshire College for years. My father's the editor of The Natural Farmer. So I've got a background as an organic farmer and in sort of the organizational movement of organic farming.
Nice.
And, you know, I spent my late teens and early 20s traveling around the country and the world working on farms in Siberia and Central America and India and living with the Navajo in the middle of the desert. Sort of just getting some perspective on agriculture. And when I got married, I realized I didn't have any viable, marketable skills besides farming. I had basically managed my parents' farm through my 20s. we had a predictable, progression of pests and diseases and things. So our crops, you know, potatoes always succumb to potato bugs, our, you know, tomatoes to blight, our brassicas to, not always, but many times to flea beetles. Just the sort of the normal issues that organic farmers struggle with. And I got to thinking about how hard I'd worked my childhood on the farm, and how I wanted to be able to have time to play with my kids. I figured if I the only thing I could do for a living was farming. I didn't want to work all the time. And perhaps if organic is supposed to be better, our plants should be healthy and resistant to diseases. So I set about looking into things and, you know, use some of my background and relationships to, you know, investigate further. But I came across a book called The Secret Life of Plants by Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird that had been edited by Joanna Compe of Northampton, the founder of Remineralize the Earth. And I read that book, was very impressed, and it said at the end, for more information, contact Remineralize the Earth, 152 South Street, Northampton, Mass. And so I did. And after a, you know, sort of a meeting of kindred spirits, Joanna asked me if I'd like to be involved with the organization. And so I, you know, got involved with Remineralize the Earth, initially as executive director, learning about and working to share what I was learning about how if you focus on building the mineral balance and the life in the soil, you create the background conditions, or the underlying conditions where your plants can thrive. So understanding what's missing, understanding how to address it. And the basic premise of Remineralize the Earth is that stone dust and seawater and naturally occurring materials are all we really need to revitalize the planet, which is very inspiring and certainly a tangent we can go on if you'd like. But I'm a farmer and I've always been more focused on farming, and so I founded the Real Food Campaign as a project of Remineralize the Earth, I think that was 2009 or so, to take these insights and more and share them with farmers, because I knew that if I had the background I had and still had issues with crop health and quality, certainly other people do also. So we've been giving year-long courses for growers of all sizes in, you know, biological systems, how to understand what limiting factors are in your situation and address them systemically, holistically, so that you can have, you know, at the foundation, healthy plants producing healthy crops that are more vigorous and taste better, have better nutrition, et cetera. So that's the quick background, but something of a background.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I would be curious to find out a little more about Remineralize the Earth. The first question that would come to my mind is, where does this rock dust come from? Is this available to local gardeners, or does it have to be trucked in from a distance?
The best stuff in the, I would say, at least 100-mile radius of Northampton is Mount Tom in East Hampton. It's a really, really rich deposit. It's already being dug up and ground up, used for pavement. But they've got a byproduct, which is fines, which is, it's got a very broad mineral spectrum. It's got a really high paramagnetic charge. It's really quite a valuable material, and it goes for between $2 and $4 a yard, I think, or a ton.
Oh, so people can drive over there and shovel it into their truck?
They've got depots around. I mean, Mount Tom is where it's mined, and there's various different companies that do the mining and you know, truck around the material.
Mm-hmm. Did I hear you say pyromagnetic? Does that mean there's iron in it?
Ferromagnetic would mean that there's iron. Paramagnetic is a much more complicated conversation. It basically means that the level of paramagnetic charge is the amount that the minerals in the material will polarize in the presence of an applied field. So if you put a magnetic field over a pile of stone dust, some of the minerals and compounds in there will orient in line with that magnetic field.
And is more good or more bad?
It's very good.
Very good.
Carbon and oxygen are both very highly paramagnetic. And when you have air in your soil and you have organic matter in your soil, your plants flourish. So, you know, you can build a paramagnetic charge in your soil through basic biological processes. But in many cases, our soils have been eroded, have been leached for 10,000 years by heavy amounts of rain, and we don't have a rich topsoil to work with. And so a lot of the base minerals that our plants need to flourish are simply unavailable to them in the soil. So using a local stone dust that has a lot of those minerals in it is a great local, sustainable, I would say almost permaculture way to revitalize your soil.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, Dan, you answered my question about the state of the state of the soil today. So what's the most important thing? We were going to focus in on best practices for soil management for gardeners today. So what is the most important thing that gardeners can do for their soil?
Well, there's a number of small things you can do. I do strongly recommend people take a soil test, you know, whatever organization you're using to take your soil test, make sure you focus on not just the macro minerals, but the trace elements. Boron and sulfur, I'll just about guarantee, are deficient in everyone's soil unless they've added them in the last 3 years. I mean, seriously deficient, like 90% of what you need is not there. But manganese is oftentimes quite low. Cobalt is almost always quite low. Zinc is good at places where people have been using compost, but copper is oftentimes low. These are critical minerals that are needed for enzymes to exist, which you need for enzymatic function, which you need for most biological processes of bacteria, fungi, plants, and animals. So when you're missing these critical minerals, the overall system function of the life, whatever kind of life it is inhibited. So taking a soil test, figuring out what's not there, and addressing it would be the first place to start.
I think you just said that boron and sulfur are just basically absent in a lot of the soil, most soil right now. So could somebody just get those additives and add them to just even a start, or is that, you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if gypsum, which you can find sometimes for $50 a ton, you would need at the rate of about 500 pounds an acre. Borax, which people can sometimes buy at pharmacies, has boron in it, and it's a, you know, naturally mined mineral, and you could use that at about 30 pounds an acre. And that would, you know, systemically work to address those deficiencies.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's the case with, you know, most of the minerals that you need. You know, each one may be $20 to $100 an acre to address a systemic deficiency. And then you're, you know, good. Maybe it'll take 2 or 3 years of going slow and steady to do it, because you don't want to just pile everything on at once. But I like to use as many naturally occurring materials as possible, primarily rocks. Certainly, cover cropping is very important. Minimizing tillage is very important. Keeping your soil covered in the summer, mulching is very important. Irrigation, keeping your soil moist, all the soil moist at all points in the year, is very important. There's a number of different topics we can go into if you'd like.
I was going to ask you what you meant by cover cropping, and then I think we're almost to a break here. So,
okay. You have a short question?
Is cover cropping a long question?
Basically, you want to keep the soil, you want to keep something growing in the soil as much as possible, and you want to keep the soil covered as much as possible. In nature, you don't see bare soil. So if we're trying to emulate nature, which I think most people would acknowledge, then you're trying to keep plants growing as long into the fall as possible, early in the spring as possible, keep some sort of an organic cover on the soil, because that's what feeds the soil life, and it's the soil life that feeds the plant.
So just a cover crop, just what would somebody put down as a cover crop? Is that?
People use, they use winter rye.
Winter rye, okay.
Field peas, different clovers, Dutch white clover, mammoth red clover. There's I said vetch, oats, buckwheat. There's what are they called? Forage radishes. There's various different crops that people use to do that. But,
yeah. Now I know, Dan, some of those are more can spread faster than others, or be more take hold, and a person might have trouble.
Yeah.
Planting something else. Are there some that are better than others, and especially in this climate?
It's a nuance. That's a nuanced answer. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the opportunity for me to pitch our upcoming soil nutrition conference.
Okay.
Called at the First Church in Northampton from the 31st of January to the 2nd of February. We're going to have it's $125 for the full conference. But the first 2 days are going to be a deep intensive in soil and best practices. So if people are interested, perhaps an opportunity. To get into the nuances is probably too complex for
An hour show. So how do people register if they're interested?
NOFAMAT.org has the form.
Okay.
The Soil and Nutrition Conference.
And you're listening to Farm to Fork on Valley Free Radio 103.3 FM. And we are talking with Dan Kittredge of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association about soil health.
So, Dan, you just mentioned cover crops. Previously, you had mentioned it's important to mulch or have a mulch cover on your garden. I'm assuming that's to prevent erosion of the soil where you might lose nutrients.
I think mulch is really important for feeding the soil. The soil is a digestive tract. It's full of bacteria and fungi, and it's alive, and it needs to be fed. And if it can be fed, then it will produce healthy plants. So the basic way that a plant works is that it goes through photosynthesis and makes sugar, and then drops those sugars out through its roots to feed the bacteria and the soil life. And the same way in the olden days you had to grow oats to feed your horse so you could ride to town, the plant makes sugar to feed the bacteria who do the work for the plant of solubilizing and digesting minerals and feeding them up to the plant in a complex form. So it's this really interesting symbiosis that goes on. But when you understand that the plant's health is critically dependent on the functionality of the soil life, then keeping the soil moist, so the soil life always has enough water to drink, keeping it aerated so they have enough air to breathe, keeping it mulched and covered with things growing that are feeding sugar is critical to keep them fed. Having good organic matter levels are good for them to live in. They live in organic structures. So it's basically a process of understanding that it's the soil life that's important and how do you take care of them.
Now, I've heard, what is your opinion on which mulches to use? I've heard some people say never use grass clippings or hay because you'll get weed seeds versus straw. But other people say, I use hay and it's fine.
Certainly there are no weed seeds in straw, or there shouldn't be. Straw is usually $8 or $10 a bale, and I can get mulch hay for $1 a bale. So I use mulch hay, and I use it generously, and I don't worry about the weeds.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on your website, Bio-Nutrient Food Association, I noticed that you talk about BRIX, B-R-I-X, and I was curious what that means. I'd never seen that term, and you say on there that an individual can measure the health of their crops with a refractometer. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. BRIX, his name was Gustav Adolphus BRIX, and I believe he was Austrian. He's a chemist. I think in the 1830s, the German vintners put out a contest, million-dollar contest, to see who could predict which grape juice would make vinegar and which grape juice would make wine. They had, limited catacombs and limited barrels, and they wanted to use only the best grape juice every year, and they had no way of figuring out which that was. And BRIX won the contest by proving that it was a specific gravity of the juice. So the denser, the heavier the juice, the better the wine it would produce. And that was basically a hydrometer that he used. But there's a Brix scale that's been developed, same way there's a Richter scale or a Fahrenheit scale or any of those systems that are named after people. And what the Brix scale is correlated to, or it's calibrated to, sorry, is percent sucrose in solution. So a refractometer, basically, if you think about, you know, putting your arm in the ocean, and you can see how it looks like it bends, mm-hmm. that's the refraction of light when it passes through water. And when if you look closely, you can see that if you put your hand in a river, it won't bend as much, apparently, as it does when you put it in the ocean, because the ocean has not just pure water, it has all the salt in it, and that makes the light bend more when it passes through the water.
Oh, the dissolved solids. Huh.
So what you have when you have plant sap, when you take a leaf of a broccoli and squish it, the juice, piece of juice out, a drop of juice out, or a kale or a carrot or a tomato, is you have a certain amount of material compounds in that sap. And what the refractometer does is, you know, with one drop of liquid, you can see how much the light bends through it. And there's a very good correlation between flavor, shelf life, nutrient value, and higher Brix readings. Mm-hmm. So you know, if you've got a 2 carats and one's a 4 Brix and one's a 10 Brix, the 4 Brix is likely to be bitter and to rot, and the 10 Brix is likely to be sweet and to keep for 6 months.
Hmm. Interesting.
So the point is, and this is part of the larger point of our organization, is that there's a severe decrease in quality in the food supply that has occurred over the past 70 years. So if you look at the USDA numbers on what was in food in the 30s and 40s and what's in food now, like micrograms of calcium per 100 grams of broccoli, there's been a dramatic decrease across the board in, you know, all crops and all compounds, basically. Some things have stayed close to the same, but most things have dropped off dramatically.
What caused that drop-off?
What's that?
What caused the drop-off? Farming practices?
Yeah, farming practices. The greater the life in the soil, the more minerals are being digested and fed up to the plant. And the less life in the soil, the less that's happening. And so when you start to put in soluble preparations of, you know, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, and effectively inject it into the plant's arm, you can make them grow big, but they aren't necessarily full of minerals and nutrition. And what actually happens is it becomes susceptible to pests and diseases.
Mm-hmm. Which requires more pesticides and more.
Right.
Vicious cycle.
So
it turbocharged it, but it's missing the basic. And that, over the last 70 years, this has happened.
Yeah. It's a long-term phenomenon, and there's a direct correlation between the decrease in mineral levels in food and the increase in degenerative disease.
Mm-hmm.
So degenerative disease is all those things they can manage but can't cure: cancer and diabetes, and you run through the list: arthritis, heart disease, all those diabetes, obesity that they can manage but they can't cure, have, you know, well, at least according to Linus Pauling, every, you know, degenerative disease has at its root mineral deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whether that's true exactly or how it's true,
or it just correlates with it, yeah.
We have this issue where our food quality is dropping and we're getting sicker, and our organization is basically out there saying, hey, how about we help farmers grow better quality food, and we help you find those farmers, you who care about being healthy, and we develop the technology to actually give anyone the capacity to test relative quality anywhere in the food supply. So what we're working on systemically as an organization is basically a version 2.0 could be an iPhone app where you flash your camera, you know, at a carrot, and it'll spit back a number at you, 64 out of 100. And you flash your camera at the next bag of carrots, and that one's at 80, and the next one's a 93.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Which bag of carrots to buy based on the functional nutrient value in those carrots, and thereby give an economic incentive to growers to do a better job in the agriculture writ large. So lots of topics to go digressing down, if you'd like.
We're going to take a break in a little bit here, but I guess we have time for one more before we take
break. Oh, yeah, Dan. Well, I was just curious, you know, can an individual purchase a refractometer, or how can they, an individual, measure their own crops?
Certainly, if you go on, you know, eBay or something, you can find them for $20. Mm-hmm. If you join our organization, we will send you a refractometer and a press to get the juice out, the sap out, and a little rich chart. But you can certainly find these things online if you want for, mm-hmm. you know, not much money.
Okay. So we are curious, how does, you had alluded earlier to the fact that soil health impacts plant pests, and so I'm curious, what can gardeners do to reduce the amount of pests in their garden just by focusing on the soil?
So if there's a flu going on now, and you bring 10 people into a room and one of them's got the flu, five people might walk out of that room with the flu and five wouldn't. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Plus or minus?
Yep.
And it's not that everyone wasn't exposed to the germs. It was the functional immunity of each person that determined whether they were susceptible or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's common sense.
Yep.
So, effectively with plants, they, you know, also have immunity. And their immunity is determined, you know, we can measure the level of the secondary metabolites, the antioxidants, the phytonutrients, the carotenoids, all these fancy-sounding names, compounds, and there's a correlation between the presence of those compounds and the plant's resistance to insects or disease, their functional immunity.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what happens is these compounds are much more are very, very complex. They're made out of fats and lipids, which are made out of proteins, which are made out of carbohydrates, which are made out of sugars. And the plant has to go through the whole chain of compound creation to be able to build these immune-enhancing compounds. And that only happens when they have a functional biological system to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So the more well you can build the vitality of the life in the soil, the more the plant's going to get everything it needs to have a healthy immune system and be strong and vital and productive.
Mm-hmm. And let's resist the pests.
Great. So let's take a
They're
short.
Probably not digestible to the pests. So what happens?
Mm-hmm.
They become indigestible.
All right. Great. So let's take a short station break. Please stay with us. As when we return, we will continue our discussion about soil health with Dan Kittredge of the BioNutrient Food Association. You are listening to Farm to Fork on Valley Free Radio, a local and independent run station. You can find us on 103.3 FM. WXOJLP Northampton, or streaming on valleyfreeradio.org, where you can listen, find the program schedule, and ways to become involved with the station.
And in Northampton, Massachusetts, hundreds of community radio activists and supporters gathered this weekend for the launch of the city's new community radio station, Valley Free Radio. With help from the Prometheus Radio Project, the low-power FM station went on the air at 2 p.m. on Sunday.
Valley Free Radio, live on the air. WXOJLP, Northampton.
I started going cold turkey. Well, at least when I'm in the car.
I know I shouldn't do it, but it's so hard to stop. That's why I hide it from myself, so I won't be tempted.
I used to do it all the time. I stopped by locking it in my glove compartment.
My friend used to do it way too much. Now I turn it off when we're in the car.
My solution is simple. I just don't do it.
There are lots of ways to stop yourself and others from texting and driving. How will you stop? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We'll be right back.
And this is you two with New Year's Day. My name is Robin. Here with me are co-producers Sue and Jessica in studio. You're listening to Farm to Fork on Valley Free Radio 103.3 FM. We have been talking about soil health with Dan Kittredge of the Bionutrient Food Association.
Hi, Dan. So I have a backup question here. Let me just ask you this. When I was young, we did radishes and carrots in a farm that used to be a pig farm. And boy, they grew great, but they had nematode bites or whatever they are all over them. And I was a little kid when my parents told me about it. But is it a problem if you have too many nematodes? Or maybe it was too wet? Or if you have any thoughts on that? It's just totally out of the blue question. But
yeah, well, I mean, imbalances in the soil functionally create imbalances in the plant. You know, if we eat imbalanced food, we become imbalanced, right? And so a lot of pig manure is going to be really, you know, hot, lots of nitrogen, which will cause them to grow big. But if you don't have enough sulfur, you can't complex that, you know, those amino acids into protein. And if you can't build protein, then you're very easily digestible or the nematodes.
Oh, yeah, they had scars all over them. Thank you. A mystery I've carried my whole life, and I'm 60, so
there's this amazing order in the natural system. I mean, this life is brilliant, and if we can attempt to understand it to the best of our ability and then attempt to create the conditions where it can thrive, that's really what it's all about. Whether it's for our soil or our plants or our bodies, our families, our communities, our culture, the planet, it's really not very complicated. We simply need to understand, you know, what makes life work and start doing that better. And you know, we believe at the Bionutrient Food Association that if we can get a higher quality of food in the food supply, we can positively impact people's health, their vigor, their intelligence, their, you know, emotional centeredness, their hormone imbalances, their spiritual coherence, and the culture at large. Not to mention, we can sequester carbon and, you know, create green where there's brown on the planet. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting, all the permutations, and it just goes from the microcosm to the macrocosm. It's I would propose it's a biological paradigm. It's looking at life through the lens of life and not as reductionist sort of abiotic chemistry and physics, but see it as life. It's really, I mean, from a farming perspective, I'm really a farmer, and that's what I do with most of my time. It happens to be much more lucrative to grow healthy plants because they're more productive, and your cost of production goes down, so you can charge a reasonable price and make more money because your plants are healthier. Mm-hmm. So I really think it's quite inspiring for people who are, you know, looking for a meaningful lifestyle. You know, this is really quite doable on a small amount of land. You can grow a lot of food and feed your family and make a nice income.
How much land do you think you need for a small family to actually be, you know, at least somewhat get, I know you can't grow everything that you need to eat, but, you know, for a family of, you know, an American family of four with two kids.
Are they going to eat, you know, vegetables and fruits and meat and grains? Or are they going to eat, you know, as far as, I think a, you know, 2 hectares is a great for a family. You can make your, feed yourself and make a living, 5 acres. You can do an amazing amount on half an acre. You can, you know, do a ton on a quarter of an acre. You know, if it's, you know, feeding your family or supplementing your diet or supplementing your income, you know.
Even a half an acre, huh?
A half an acre. We made on our farm this year, I would say, I mean, about $30,000 on a third of an acre in, say, 8 or 9 months, doing about 15, 20 hours a week.
Wow.
Sounds great.
It's very doable. It's very doable. So you need less space. You know, we from my perspective, I've spent enough time in other parts of the world to know that a lot of people are suffering a lot more than we are in this country. And, you know, these tools, this understanding of life and living systems and, you know, being able to read the environment for the natural materials that are readily available, that is all we need to revitalize life, means that we can turn, you know, Africa and India and Central Asia and all these places where in the American West, you know, where the soil is really wearing out and desertifying, we can bring them back to green. We can really do this.
In your travels, have you been to any country where the practices are more consistent with this? You know, our Western culture, we've really sold a lot of the fertilizers and all that. But is there a place that you've traveled or that you know about that, you know, this is really an entrenched, almost a traditional method?
A lot of these things are all common sense and, you know, have been applied by indigenous communities all over the planet. I think that, you know, have you ever read 1491?
No.
This amazing book lays out the brilliant permaculture system that the, you know, Native Americans were applying here, you know, in the Northeast when white man first came, and it was brilliant. I mean, who knows what they were doing in the, you know, ancient times, but I think there are, you know, we can look into it and see what they're doing. You know, as far as our culture and our situation, I don't think that's realistic. We're still going to have companies and private property and marketing and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So, I mean, the real question for me is how can we make it economically advantageous and really drive that for people to do the right thing, grow food, not just pounds of commodity, and high-quality food, pharmaceutical-grade food, you could even say. You know, good food can provide the minerals your body needs to function well and thereby become, you know, resistant to disease.
Mm-hmm.
We can cure ourselves with good food. We don't have much of it really available. We have, you know, a lot of well-meaning, you know, local farmers and non-local farmers, and a lot of them are doing a decent job, but, you know, it's really hard to say that anybody's really doing a top-notch job right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where we're at, is trying to, you know, those people who say this makes sense and I want to try to do it, we're all learning and implementing and getting some pretty nice responses and results, and it's sort of bubbling up. So,
well, Dan, I think I can surmise your answer to this question, but I thought I would ask anyway, what are your thoughts on monoculture versus a diversified crop system in terms of soil?
I mean, nature, you never see monoculture in nature. Polyculture is obviously the best way to do things. That's not necessarily realistic for a lot of farms as they're managed. So, you know, that's why I suggest if you can cover crop and you can put at least three different species of cover crops in together when you're planting them, you'll get that benefit of that polyculture effect on the soil life, at least for part of the year. I think minimizing tillage is important. I think, you know, if quality is a metric, then people who have a human scale operation probably going to be able to do the best job.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for me, the question is, the data is out there saying that some organic is better, some organic is worse. You know, some conventional is better, some conventional is worse. Some local is better, some local is worse,
mm-hmm.
from a nutritional standpoint. And, you know, it seems to me if we, the people, could know which was better in any given situation and were able to choose that better crop, that would give a real clear motivation for everybody else to do better.
You mentioned a couple of times managing tillage. What exactly do you mean by that? I'm ignorant of these practices, so if you could lay it out for the layperson.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about the soil, there are, you know, trillions, quadrillions, you know, uncountable numbers of individual living organisms in the top 6 inches of soil. You know, absolutely astronomical numbers of individual organisms. And when you go through and you till 6 inches down, you shred their entire ecosystem and you've got mass die-off. If you want to, technically it would be genocide. You're wiping out, you know, massive numbers of individual organisms, and that has a really negative effect on the soil structure, on the roots, the plants, the soil life, and the plants' health. So,
why did people do that? Why did they do that to turn it over like that? Then,
it's entrenched habit, and it's the way things have been done. It's not done everywhere, but it's economical on a large piece of land to just come through with a tractor that's 50 feet wide and a arrow that's 50 feet wide and just rip everything up. People are learning and people are doing better. It's getting better, but basically minimizing your tillage. If you till 1 inch deep, you can prepare the soil bed without tilling, 80% of the soil life.
Wow.
And that's, it's a minor change. There's all these little things you can do. You can inoculate your seed. You can, effectively put the colostrum onto the seed when it germinates, when it's born, it has a functioning digestive tract. Very inexpensive, very simple, profound in its effect.
What do you mean by inoculate the seed?
When a baby is born, it needs the colostrum from the mother's milk to set its digestive tract.
Yep, antibiotics and all that. Yep, I mean antibodies.
Yeah, antibodies and probiotics. If a baby cow does not get the colostrum, it'll probably be colicky and die within 6 weeks. It's the flora in our gut that digests our food for us, and when we don't have a well-established gut flora, we are systemically unhealthy, and that is exactly true with plants, except that plants' gut flora is on the root surface. Plants have external digestive tracts, and animals have internal digestive tracts, but you still need to establish the intestinal flora in the plant to have it be healthy. It needs its colostrum. And so you can buy little packets of spores that'll have, 30, 40, 50 different species of symbiotic bacteria and fungi, and, put a pinch of it into your seed packet, and, have a dramatically positive effect on the health of that plant for its entire life cycle.
Wow.
So there's a number of little, key little things. Do this and this, and this is why, and here, yep. That we cover. And that's what the organizational courses are about. That's what we cover. I do lectures, so if anybody wants me to come and talk to a library group or a, gardening group, whatever, I'm certainly available to come and give lectures.
Yeah, thank you for going through that, because I really didn't understand what you were saying. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for asking.
And you are listening to Farm to Fork on Valley Free Radio 103.3 FM. We are talking about soil health with Dan Kittredge of the Bionutrient Food Association.
So, Dan, I was curious how soil health might impact the amount of water used in someone's garden.
Well, a healthy soil has a high level of organic matter in it. Mm-hmm. It also has... It's loose deep into the subsoil, so it can wick soil up from the subsoil, but it can also hold much more water over longer periods of time. So certainly you can dramatically reduce your water need if you build a soil structure and life.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be able to hold more water, which means you won't have to water as often.
They say organic matter can hold four times its weight in water, or mm-hmm. maybe 10 times its weight in water. I think it's four times its weight in water. Mm-hmm. So every pound of organic matter you have, means your soil can hold 4 pounds more water.
Hmm. So I was also curious whether soil health can be generalized to some extent, no matter what edible plants you plan to grow, or do we need to keep in mind the types of crops we'll be growing, for example, acid-loving versus non-acid-loving plants?
Yeah, my understanding is that there's certain basic enzymes that are necessary for just about all biological system function. There's, copper-based enzymes, zinc-based enzymes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you must have a basic level of a broad spectrum of minerals present in your soil if you want your plants to flourish. Mm-hmm. There's certainly different nuances about, soil structure and, type and all that kind of stuff that are, where different plants have evolved to flourish in different conditions. But primarily, you can make some pretty basic suggestions that will be very beneficial for just about all plants.
Mm-hmm. So earlier you alluded to healthier crops having a better flavor. On your website, you mentioned that soil health affects the flavor, aroma, nutrition, and longevity of a crop. Can you talk to what it is specifically in soil that can maximize a crop's flavor, aroma, nutrition level, and longevity?
It's, again, those secondary metabolites. What makes an onion taste like an onion, what makes a cabbage taste like a cabbage, you know. In the cabbage, it's the brassicosins that are secondary metabolites that are built by the plant that give it the resistance to disease and pest, also give it flavor and what we call nutrient value.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this beautiful symbiosis where those things which taste the most, you know, are most aromatic, most flavorful, most, you know, delicious, are actually technically best for us. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, last winter we, you know, sold most of our carrots and juiced the rest, and by January or so we had used up everything we had, and we went and bought a 50-pound bag of organic carrots from our local health food store, and they were atrocious. I mean, they were bitter. Mm-hmm. They were absolutely, you know, repugnant in relation to what we had just been eating, and they sat in the cooler and rotted because we didn't eat them. You know, they were organic carrots, but they were nutritionally entirely different, and it was very evident to the taste. So, in reality, our tongues and our noses are very good nutrient meters. We've been, you know, we've evolved them over very long periods of time to do just that, to tell us what's good for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the way you think about a good wine having, you know, all the different notes and, you know, after flavors, you know, cinnamon with, you know, blueberry or whatever it is they all say. You know, taste your carrots that way, taste your cucumbers that way, taste your kale that way, and you can begin to just discern just through your own, you know, body who's got the best crops and what's good and what's not.
Mm-hmm. So how can people maintain soil health, you know, keeping in mind sustainable practices in the most sustainable way? I presume it's not very sustainable to add, you know, a lot of nutrients from bags of supplements that travel across the country, across the world. Is it possible to talk about a sustainable soil system without addressing the issue of municipal composting or backyard composting and humanure?
I think, from my perspective, between rock dust, like granite, which the crust is made out of, and seawater, we have all the raw ingredients we would ever need to import. So I would say there needs to be no bagged, processed, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, products used. That's not necessary. It may be, you know, easier, and people may do it, but it's not necessary. So I think, you know, composting is certainly very valuable. The biggest problem with compost is that it is what it's made out of. And if you're taking boron-deficient and sulfur-deficient organic matter, and you're building your compost pile out of it, you're not going to get more boron and sulfur in your compost pile, and you're still going to have a systemic deficiency.
Good point. Wow.
So,
all those scraps from your table, if they weren't good to begin with, oh my goodness.
Doesn't it make sense?
Oh, yeah. Perfect sense.
Yeah. So I would take my rock dust and my seawater, and I'd put it in my compost pile.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, you know, extraordinarily valuable material.
So I was also curious about container. So people who like to do container gardening, how might somebody improve the health of their potting mix? They can, again, add the rock dust?
Yeah. I mean, you need the same basic minerals present in your soil, regardless of what the container is.
Mm-hmm.
And the same species of biology, and the same air, and the same water, and the same carbon. You need to have the biological system functioning well if you want the plant to flourish. So, you know, certainly a buck a bag, you know, whatever they call it, garden soil, you can buy some big box store probably doesn't have the full spectrum of biological components that are actually what's critically important. So, you know, I can't make a specific recommendation because everyone's using a slightly different material. But certainly, the same principles apply regardless of what you're growing in.
You know, this is sort of going back a little bit on questions, but, you know, my backyard has pine trees all around it, and there's always a big, especially the white pines and the cedars. Is that a no-no for a garden to have those kind of standing pines around it? I understand it makes it acid, or maybe it doesn't make it acid, but are pine needles, I mean, it seems like they're organic. They should be fine.
Everything that you use has an effect on the system, and you need to understand it to understand what the effect is. And generally, too much of anything is not good. So there's a very good correlation between pines and evergreens and acidic soil. The bigger question I'd be worried about is shading and the roots. How far away from the trees is your garden? Because if not very far, tree roots are probably...
They're taking all the nutrients?
Competing with and making it slowly difficult for your plants to flourish. If it was me, I'd cut them down and put up some fruit trees.
I totally understand what you're saying. I struggle with that.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty, and the birds like them.
the birds would like a nice, perennial hedge full of nuts and berries, and so would your butterflies and all your beneficial insects. You could put up, a nice hedgerow like they have in England, 10 feet tall, full of amazing productivity.
I got a petition signed by my local bears that they wanted hazelnuts. So,
yeah.
The handwriting was a little rough, though.
Oh, so Dan, I have a worm composting box going on in my basement.
Yeah.
What do you think about adding worm casting supplements to the soil?
I think worm castings are an amazing material. Certainly very, very good. And again, if you know what your soil needs and you put some of those minerals into your box, the worms will digest them and they'll be bioavailable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you can get some of Mount Tom, just get a yard. It costs you $20, and you can use it for mending your soil for a generation.
Mm-hmm. So before the show started, Sue was mentioning that she had put compost on this fall, right?
And yep, it
was
this fall.
It seemed like it was maybe a few months too early.
Yeah, the Holiday Farm said that it was actually next year's compost, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what would you say to that, Dan, that someone could do if they realized, oh, shoot, this compost isn't completely composted, but they put it on anyway? Is there anything they can do, or is that going to be okay in the spring for her to plant in?
If you put it on now, and I'm assuming it wasn't outrageously thick, it'll probably be mellowed enough to be fine in the spring. Mm-hmm. Compost is a term that, capital C compost is a brilliant, amazing thing, and there's a lot of things that people call compost that are, effectively putrefied organic material.
Yeah, it hasn't quite, this looked pretty good, actually. I was surprised they said it wasn't ready.
If my basic rule of thumb is if you let a child play in it, it's compost.
You should have seen my dogs. They weren't allowed in the house, but...
Yeah, I mean, if it's smelled and has a consistency that, you'd be fine with a 2-year-old playing on the pile, then you've got nothing to be concerned about.
By the spring, I think I'll be okay with that.
Oh, so one last quick question, Dan, before we have to wrap it up. So for those individual listeners out there who aren't able to grow their own crops, is there anything they can do as consumers to positively impact soil health?
Certainly by supporting your local farmers. Mm-hmm. And specifically by letting them know that you're interested in, nutrient value in the crop. I think in the Pioneer Valley there's an amazing slew of really good farmers. And, whether you go to the farmer's market or whether you have a CSA share or whether you buy from, a local health food store, getting a refractometer is very, very intriguing. And it's very eye-opening because you begin to see that the most food that's out there is really pretty poor. And you start to, you know, maybe this will start to sink in, and you'll start to think about the health of your children and the health of your spouse or your own health. And, I'd like people to take the refractometers and go test all the shares that come from all the different farms.
Would you give us when your seminar is coming up again? And then we're going to end up closing because we're right at the end of this show.
We're having a soil and nutrition conference. It's going to be held at the First Church in Centertown, December 31st.
Center of Northampton, is that it?
January 31st, February 1st and 2nd. It's $125. It's a collaboration between NOFA Massachusetts and the Bionutrient Food Association. And for anybody who's at all curious, is a farmer, knows a farmer, wants to learn how to be a better gardener, I think it's a really amazing opportunity. It's a real gem.
Sounds wonderful. Well, we want to thank you, Dan Kittredge of the Bionutrient Food Association, for sharing today with us. This was really a real eye-opener of a show today, so thank you very much. And he, shared his best practices for our biological soil management with gardeners. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to Farm to Fork as we discussed soil health with Dan Kittredge of the Bionutrient Food Association. You may find additional information on the Valley Free Radio website, replay show podcasts, or find links to resources on our Yahoo group, which is groups.yahoo.com/group/VFR Farm to Fork. And we will see you again February 5th.